Okay. Good evening.
Good evening.
What am I doing over here? We're doing this over here. I gotta
smile.
This is strange. Very strange. Okay, so a few things before we begin. Since this is the first time that we're doing this on Zoom, where people... Who's sharing their screen? Somebody should not be sharing their screen. No, over here. No. Only host. There we go. Okay. A few things. So number one, since we're broadcasting, we have, for those who are listening on broadcast, we have a chat, okay? What we're going to use the chat for, this is all experimental now, we're going to hopefully that it work, you know, see that it works. What we're going to use the chat for is if you have questions in the course of the lecture, you can write your questions on the chat. And at the end of the lecture, at the end of the shiur, I'll read through the question. I may not answer all of them, but I'll answer what I can. So I'll answer questions from the audience, and then I'll answer questions from the people, you know, who post in the chat. So that's number one. Those who are on the chat who want to follow the source sheet, I've posted the address, the URL for the source sheet on the chat, at the top of the chat. So you should see it over there, and you should be able to pick it up from there. Now, but that's not what I want to do. Is my screen still shared? No, I hope not. Okay. People online, have I shared my screen with everybody still? No. Yes? No. Yes? You should nod your head. Okay, those of you also who are online, please mute. You can find the mute button at the bottom left of your screen. If you scroll, if you use, bring your cursor down, your mouse down at the bottom left of your screen, mute you. Mute yourself. Because even though I have my computer muted, the other people may not, and it's going to be distracting. So you listen. If you want to ask any questions, type them out on the chat. All right? Yes, welcome. Good evening. This is our first Morasha lecture. And what I have asked everyone to read for tonight are three chapters in Herman Wouk's book, The Will to Live On. That reading is going to be unique. It's going to be a little bit different than what I will ask everyone to read in the coming months. I've asked everyone to read Herman Wouk because I find him to be very eloquent, very educated. He is an observant Orthodox Jew that lives in Palm Springs. And he's, I think, 101. Please, God, may he live well, live long and be well. 102. May he live long and be well. I don't know Herman Wouk personally, but he wrote This Is My God over maybe 60 years ago. And he's written The Will to Live On fairly recently. And in This Is My God, he writes about Judaism in general. But in The Will to Live On, he writes about the observance. He talks much more about the nature of Torah, of the makeup of our Torah, and other things. And so the three chapters that I've asked everyone to read, not that you shouldn't read the rest of the book, by all means read the rest of the book, but we've got permission from the publishing house to give you those chapters. And those three chapters speak about our Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah. The reason why I'm saying that it's going to be different than what I normally give you is two reasons. Number one, I will normally give you in the coming months to read, everyone coming read, classical texts. Yeah, there'll be texts from the Rambam, there'll be texts from Rabbi Yehuda Levi, there'll be texts from Rabbeinu Bachya ben Pakuda, there'll be texts from Ramchal ben Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. I'm going to take classical texts and we're going to look at those. And essentially what we're going to be focusing on during, in the course of the Morasha study, are principles. The goal of this Morasha study is to be able to bring the community into a sense of the principles of Torah. It will have a strong emphasis on the Sfaradi, traditional, historic Sfaradi approach to the principles of Torah, although it's not exclusive, as we will see, to the Sfaradim. It's just an element of it or an approach that the Sfaradim have classically, usually embraced and accepted. And so, as the Hachamim write in the Midrash, Le'olam nekot biyadecha klalim. When you're studying, always study principles, so that when you experience details, you can embed the details, you can absorb the details into the frameworks and principles that you know. My goal here is to be able to provide principles. Essentially, in all of my teaching, I try to provide principles, but here we're going to give basics. I'm going to work on giving out basics. So the first thing that I wanted to put out was simply, what is the Torah? And we shouldn't take for granted that we know necessarily what the Torah is. I mean, we really do have to think about it. And it's one of those things that even if we're educated and we study in in Jewish classes, Jewish day schools, Jewish shiurim, whatever the case may be, it's almost taken as though it's a given. We're studying Torah. But nobody, rarely does anyone actually say, well, what is Torah? And how am I supposed to understand it? And so that's what I want to look at tonight. Now, of course, there are many aspects that we can look. I'm going to take one track in terms of how it is that we're looking at it tonight. And the second reason that that Hermann Wouk is going to be Yotze Min HaKlal, or not the regular type of text that I'm going to give out, is because I am not necessarily going to be studying Hermann Wouk with you. Yeah, Hermann Wouk, the purpose of that, of the Will to Live On, and the chapters that I gave you, was to, as an entree, it was to open up the door to the world of Torah. And I think that he just does it very well, just so that you understand, what are the five books, what are the prophets, what comprised of? What are the scriptures? What's the Talmud? And he really does a pretty decent job of giving over and explaining it. So what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to move beyond that. I'm going to use the fact that you've read that as a base, and we're going to build on that base. Now you'll see in the source sheets, I've quoted some of his quotes in the middle, of the source sheet. As we go along, we'll look at some of the things that he put out and see how it connects or tethers to what it is that I want to present tonight. The last thing that I'm going to say is I would very much like, if possible, when we are done tonight, and our social contract is about an hour, maybe an hour and 15, we'll see, I'll do my best, but I'm being realistic. I would like to pray Arvit when we're done. So if you guys don't mind to hang out, we'll pray Arvit before we leave. All right. Let's open up. What we want to talk about tonight is the written Torah and the oral Torah and how I'm supposed to relate to these things. So there is a glaring issue in the Torah itself. First of all, we would expect that Torah, being as central as it is for the Jewish people, I mean, regardless of what you say, no matter how observant or not observant, no matter what element of Judaism we are, we recognize that Torah is very central to Judaism itself. And the glaring issue is that Torah is not spoken about by God to our forefathers at all. That's a very serious issue. And it's one that we have to wonder about. I mean, it's okay to say, listen, God waited until a nation developed in order to be able to give a Torah. And what we're looking at tonight is definitely an Orthodox perspective. That's also a given. I'm not giving a survey of all of the different sects of Judaism and how it is that they relate to Torah. When you come here, our Morasha program, it's an Orthodox program. And so I'm presenting Torah from that perspective. Torah from that perspective is that we see Torah as being given by God. So if I take that as a given, which we are tonight, we're not going to discuss that at the moment, but if we take that as a given, we can understand perhaps that God waits to give Torah and Mount Sinai to an entire nation, but not a word about it until it's given. Not only is there not a word about it, when he hires Moshe for the job, first of all, that he hires Moshe for is not to give the Torah. What does he hire Moshe for? To get them out of Egypt and bring them into the land of Israel, or the land of Canaan as it was, and ultimately to achieve the land of Israel. It's only mid-job that God says to him, by the way, we've got an issue that we have to take care of. I'm going to need you to give them this stuff, this text. Yeah, I have a Torah that I want to give them. God only hints to this when he hires Moshe in his office on the mountain. So Moshe is sitting in God's office. God says, look, I've got a job for you. I need to get my people out of there. My firstborn is you know, under the hands of Paro. You're going to have to go in and talk to him. It's a whole discussion, right? There's an entire back and forth between God and Moses. Moses gives him an extremely difficult time. You figure you're coming for a job interview. You should try to be on your best behavior. The Hachamim say that what we see in the Torah is only shorthand. What we see in Torah is only a snippet of what really went on. We have a tradition that 7 days Moshe was in dialogue with God. Back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And so essentially what happens is, oh, by the way, you're going to take them out of Egypt, ta'avdunoti ala harazeh, and you will serve me on this mountain. That's all that's said. Doesn't say how, what. You would imagine God says, look, Moses, we've got some real great stuff going on here for the Jewish people. I have a book. They're going to love this, right? You're going to love this. I have the book. I've had it waiting for me forever. I'm going to come out. I'm going to do a grand opening. I'll do book signing. You know, there's going to be a whole thing. You know, it's going to be on display. None of that. None of that. And that is what I want to explore as our foundational point tonight. God does not speak of Torah. Not to Abraham, not to Yitzhak, not to Yaakov, not to Moshe when he's hired, except for that one allusion that he says, ta'avdunoti ala harazeh. What does God speak about? God speaks about covenant over and over and over again. God mentions brit. And there is one central component to the brit. There is the covenant. And then there is the main issue of the covenant. And the main issue of the covenant, of course, is... See, it's amazing. I mean, should we not know this at the time? I mean, this should be top of our... Land! The main issue of covenant is land, land, land. Location, location, location. It's all about location. That's all that's discussed. There is a little bit here and there where God says, you know, I know Abraham is going to keep my laws. What laws? You know, the things that I tell him. I know that he'll teach his children after him. But there's no mention of the fact that there's going to be a Torah and so on and so forth. Even Moshe, when he's hired, as we said, his job is to get them to the land. That's why he's hired. They're stuck in the wrong land. We have to get them out of the wrong land and get them to the right land. I'm going to help you with this, Moses, but we're going to get them there. Okay? So that is essential to be aware of. That the entirety of our relationship with God, and if we are going to look at Judaism as a present manifestation of that relationship, or at least a present context for that relationship, we need to understand the basic fundamentals of the relationship. And the basic fundamentals of the relationship precede Torah. Torah is a means to an end, right? And the ends that essentially we're looking at is the covenant itself. And we find that the central element of covenant is land. So let's take a look. The first thing that you have on the sheets, number one, Bayomahu. On that day, forget about, the English is there just so that you can connect, but I'm probably going to translate, it's not my translation. Bayomahu, on that day, karat Adonai et Abram brit lemor. On that day, God cut a covenant with God saying, Lezaracha natati et haaretz hazot. I have given your seed this land. Minahar Mitzrayim adanahar gadol nehar perat. From the river of Egypt all the way down to the great river, the Euphrates. Covenant, land. It's elaborated. It's elaborated later on. God says to Abraham, Ani El Shaddai. I am Shaddai, Hitalech lefanai ve'yetamin. Walk before me. Be wholesome. Complete. Etenad b'riti b'ni u'b'necha. And I will place my covenant between me and you. I'll make you plentiful. Vaypol Avraham al panav. Avraham hears this, falls to his face, and God continues to speak with him as Abraham has now fallen to the floor, hearing God speaking to him. Ani hine b'riti itach. Again, Listen, hear, my covenant is with you. V'hayita le'av hamon goyim, you're going to be a father of a great many nations. Your name shall not be Avram anymore, but Avraham. Ki av hamon goyim, because you are a father of many nations. V'friti otecha, and I will make you plentiful. V'irbiticha, right? B'mod me'od, daticha le'goyim lachim yimechei yetzeo. I'm an ultimate, tremendously plentiful. Kings are going to come from you. Again, v'hakimoti in 7, v'hakimoti et b'riti b'ni u'b'necha, and I will uphold my covenant between me and you. U'ben zarecha, and your children, aharecha, that come after you, ledorotam, for all of their generations, b'rit olam, an eternal covenant. Liyot lecha Elohim, for what? To be a God for you. I will be your God. And to your children after you. And what are the terms? I'm going to give your children this land. Eretz Megurecha. It kol Eretz Canaan. The whole land of Canaan. La'huzat olam, as an eternal acquisition. It is theirs forever. Again, Vayiti lahem l'Elohim. The redundancies here are glaring. Covenant, covenant, covenant. I am going to be their God. Me personally, not an angel, not anyone else. Me personally, I'm looking after your children in this land, this land, this land, this land. Now you, Abraham, you keep safe my covenant. That's your job. Protect it. Tishmor. Shmira, protect it. Atav is aracha harecha ledorotam. You, your children after you, all of your generations. That's our deal. That's our agreement. Zot beriti, this is my brit. You shall. Then he talks about circumcision. So you see what we're talking about? Now, wouldn't this be a good place to talk about Torah? It's like perfect. It would be perfect. You know, one line in there. With all the redundancies, you could slip one line in. And say, and by the way, Torah is going to be a wonderful way to live. Not a word. Not one. So Herman Wouk, he writes, Abraham's covenant. Notice how he writes this, right? When he talks about Sinai, he explains Sinai in one pasuk, in one sentence. What happened at Sinai? Abraham's covenant is renewed between the Creator and all Israel, a commitment that for all faithful among us is binding to this hour. This hour. It's true. But that's what happens at Sinai. And so what we have to understand, it's important for us to understand, that if we are to recognize Torah at all within the milieu of Israel and God and covenant and ultimately Judaism, it is an element of covenant. And that when it is given to us at Sinai, it is only for the sake of the Abrahamic covenant. So Torah must be recognized first and foremost as the mode of covenant between us and God. It is our brit. As opposed to what? As opposed to a book of morals. As opposed to a book of ethics, as opposed to a book to create strong societies, as opposed to a book to create plentiful, viable communities, as opposed to a book to be able to help you with your life as a wonderful self-help book. All of those things it may be, but it isn't its goal. Those things are ancillary and derivatives when one engages in covenant with God. In other words, if you're going to engage in covenant with the source of all of existence, existence is going to do well. But its goal is not any of those things. And that means that when Torah is in our lives, or if we're questioning the nature of Torah in our lives, it is always only one question. How am I engaging, or what does it mean to me vis-a-vis covenant? That's it. It's the only question. And so we see that the way that Torah is presented, astonishingly, is only as a system in which we should live the covenant on the land. In other words, the purpose of giving Torah at Sinai on the way out of Egypt to the land of Canaan, which ultimately becomes Eretz Israel, is to provide a framework of life in order to be able to adhere to covenant. You want to know how you should live in covenant when you get there? Here, I've got guidelines. So the Ramban Nachmanides has a very beautiful way of looking at it. And he says, for all intents and purposes, it's important to realize the entirety of Torah, not just the laws that happen to do with actually tilling the land and the, you know, the sabbatical years and the planting of you know, different species together and all of these issues, or the sacrifices that are brought in the temple. You know, those are the things that we call mitzvot ha-tluyot ba'aretz. Those are mitzvot that are connected to the land. Nachmanides says, no, all of the mitzvot are connected to the land. They're only meant really to be done in the land. So yes, there are some that we hold even when we're off the land. You know, we maintain them because of the nature of, you know, how they affect us, because they're things that we do for ourselves as individuals, and so we maintain them. But don't make the mistake of thinking that the mitzvot of the Torah are meant to be kept anywhere outside of the land of Israel. We keep them because there are things that we keep no matter where we go. We take them with us as expats of the land of Israel. But for all intents and purposes, the goal of Torah is in order to be able to provide life in the land. The whole of it is meant to be lived in the land. And that's important to remember. Look, keep that here, okay? Putting that here. The whole of Torah is meant to be lived in the land. I'll get back. I'll bring it back in a minute. Okay? Take a look at what Ramban writes in number 4. I'm sorry I don't have the English for this. He brings a pasuk in Yirmiyah where he says, I have established for you points, markers. What are the markers? Mitzvot. The mitzvot are our markers for our people. She Yisrael mitzuyanim behem. We are marked by them. We are detected, identified by the mitzvot that we keep, the Jewish people. Vehine ha-katuv she'amar, right? There's a pasuk, there's a verse that says, v'ivadtem mehera. You will lose. You will be lost from the land. You will get be dispersed away from the land. You should take my words and put them on your heart, lest that happen. Now, enu mehayev begalut. When does it say that we're going to be thrown off the land, or lose the land, or be dislodged from the land? When we don't engage in the mitzvot. So the mitzvot are tied to the land. And if we don't recognize the mitzvot as an element of covenant, then we're off the land. And so it says, you know, the only, he says, Enu mechayev begalut ele bechovat aguf ketfilin, mzuzot, upirshu behen, kedei sheliyu chadashim alenu, kshenachzor le'eretz Yisrael la'aretz. So the only things that we take with us if we're put off the land are what? The things that we do with our body. Tefillin, mezuzahs on our house, you know, wherever it is that we've got to go. Things that are part of our person or personal life, that we take with us. And he says an astonishing thing. Why do we do that? Why do we take them with us? Listen to this. Nachmanides says the reason why we take those mitzvot with us, even when we're not on the land, is so we don't forget them. So that when we come back, we remember how to live on the land. Do you hear this? Do you sense the massive switching of context to how we do you understand what the implications of this are for Judaism? I mean, Judaism is just supposed to be a religion. You know, I mean, this is the religion. This is the way that we do things, the Jews. No, what Nachmanides is saying, it's a covenant with God, and the systems of adherence are meant to be done on the land. We take the mitzvot with us that are personal, and the essential reason that we take them with us, these things that we can hold on our bodies and our personal lives and our homes, is because we don't want to forget. When we get back eventually, we should have practice in them. We should be familiar with them so that we can practice them again when we get back there. And he doesn't just leave it like that. He gives a whole analogy, which I didn't put on the pages. So, Ikar kol mitzvot liyoshvim be'eretz Hashem. The main aspect of all of the mitzvot, not just the mitzvot that have to do with the land, all of the mitzvot are those that sit in the land of God. Ulfichach amru b'sifre v'irishtem otah v'shavtem ba u'shmartem la'asot. You will accept it, You will inherit it, you will sit on the land, and you will protect and keep and do the mitzvot that I have. Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, the sitting in Eretz Yisrael, the living in the land of Israel, Shekula keneged kol ha-mitzvot sheba-Torah, is equal to all of the mitzvot of the Torah. What does that mean? Not like people think that if I'm living in the land of Israel, I don't have to keep any of the mitzvot of the Torah. It's the opposite. It is equal in the sense that it is contextual for all the mitzvot of the Torah. So if I put it on, okay, the context is what defines the entirety of the mitzvot. You hear this? Everybody with me? Okay. So, oh, look at that, water. Now, there's another aspect of this that are tremendous implications as far as covenant is concerned. Baruch Ata Adonai Elohim Melech HaOlam SheHakol Nihyeh Baruch. If what we're saying is indeed the case, that covenant is the foundational idea, well, the definition of covenant is that it's got two sides, right? I mean, it's not a one-way covenant. The definition of covenant is that there are two parties that are coming into agreement. And in this covenant, the two parties are God and us. And a covenant isn't simply a spectator sport. There are responsibilities on both parties. So it's not just the responsibility of God to provide for us life and we adhere to the mitzvot that He gives us. Yes, that's part of it. And it's partnership in the full sense of the word. But if Torah is, as we are saying, that before it is a moral document, an ethical document, a societal document, it is a document of covenant, then that means that there must be also the manifestation of covenant in the Torah itself. In other words, in the engagement of Torah, there must be two sides. There's the God part of Torah, and there's the Israel part of Torah. And this is also something that we tend to misunderstand. We think of Torah as God-given. Don't touch it. Do it. Don't touch it. But that's not covenantal. That's obedient, but it's not covenantal. It isn't a partnership. It is, I'm telling you, and you're doing. But if it is covenantal, then it is I am providing, and you are providing. I'm taking responsibility, and you are taking responsibility. And the question is, what are the elements of that responsibility, not just in terms of adherence of Torah law, but in terms of the actual participation of Torah itself? In other words, if Torah is covenant, then participation in that covenantal peace should be dual parties. Now, in order to be able to explore this, right, we're going to have to see how it is that the Chachamim see this. But I want to look at, clearly, without question, that the nature of the giving of Torah is indeed as Wook said it was. I mean, it's nice that Herman Wook said it, but we don't exactly hang our religion on what he writes. You know, I mean, it's nice to have his ideas. But how do we know? How does he know that? That that's the case. Well, the Nachmanides, the fact that he's saying that the mitzvot of the Torah essentially are all mechanisms for the actual living in the land, that's pretty powerful. But how do I know that Sinai was the renewal of the covenant, as he says? Or the establishment, I don't know if I would say renewal, I would say the establishment of the covenant. Harambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimonides, in his Mishneh Torah, he talks about Avodah Zarah, foreign worship, you know, worshipping gods other than God. And he tells a story, which is very unlike him. He doesn't start law, right? It's a law book. Right? He's talking about laws of what happens to a person who worships the wrong god and so on, what is considered worshipping the wrong god and so on and so forth. He opens with a story. Story of who? Abraham. Why the story of Abraham? Tell the story of Abraham, because Abraham was the first one to discover God. At least in our tradition, we recognize him as being the guy who recognizes God. And how does he recognize God? He recognizes that everything else is not God. I mean, if I'm talking about God, I'm talking about one entity, and these things can't be that entity, because I'm looking for primal existence, which is, by the way, next Morasha. I'm not getting into that now. I mean, once we know about Torah and we know who we are, we can talk about God, right? Which we will. So what Maimonides does is by the end of the story, he says, so we've got an issue. What's the problem? The problem is that it's very nice that Abraham discovers God. But we're paralyzed. You know, you're telling me you have a covenant. What's the nature of the covenant? The land. Wonderful. So you're just telling me I'm just supposed to like roam around on the land? And that's the covenant? Are there no actions that we engage in? Is there no endeavors that we share? Is there a project that we're working on together? You know, anything? Oh, no, yeah, there definitely is. Good. So are you going to tell me or? I mean, I'm going to get information or should I just like, you know, decide this in my own head? Should I make up the covenant, the covenantal ideas? I mean, that's not very much covenant-oriented, is it? I mean, if we're going to be two sides, then I want to hear something from the other side and tell me what the project should involve. Umehavat Adonai Otanu, in number two. No, number five, sorry. Umehavat Adonai Otanu, from God's, out of God's love for us. Next phrase, very important. Umishomro et Shivua le'Avraham Avinu. And by his keeping of the swear, the oath that he took with Abraham, which is what? What's the oath? The covenant, right? So in keeping with the swearing of the oath of covenant to Abraham, what did he do? Great line over here. Asa Moshe Rabbeinu. He made this Moses creation, right? He doesn't say he sent Moses. He says he made Moses and sent him. Which is an astonishing phrase. Because what Rambam is saying is that Moshe's entire being was created for one purpose. And that was to establish the Abrahamic covenant. In other words, there's no Abraham, there's no Moses. The only reason Moses is at all Moses, and we recognize Moses as being Rabbeinu, right, our master, is because of the covenant of Abraham, because we're the children of Abraham. We're Zarecha. We're the seed that he talks about at the beginning. So in order to be able to facilitate this, he makes Moses Ushlaha, and he sends him. Why does he send him? I got to let you know how to do the covenant. So in his words, he makes Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our master, Rabban Shel Kol Nevi'im, the master of all prophets. And that we will look at again in later classes, because we're going to talk about prophecy and what role it plays in terms of the mitzvot themselves. It's not for tonight, but he makes a point of saying this, the Rambam. Kevan shenitnabe Moshe Rabbeinu, as Moshe prophecies, ubahar Adonai Yisrael nahala, and God chose Israel as his nahala. What is it right? Nahala, his inheritance. All right, hichtiran b'mitzvot, he crowned them with mitzvot. The mitzvot, the commandments, are essentially the terms from God's end of the covenant. This is his offering of the covenant. And he finally informed them how they could serve. In other words, how could they engage? I mean, if I don't tell you, how are you supposed to know? So he informed them. And what would be the judgments for those who worship anything other than God? So this is the whole, notice the framing of the entire giving of the Torah is only in order to be able to facilitate the covenant. Same thing is done in number 6. I'm not going to read it out to you, but if you read it in the English, this is the preamble. What you're reading in number 6 is the preamble before Torah is actually given on Mount Sinai. And the entire thrust of the preamble is relationship. I will be your God. You will be my people. You are a treasure to me among all nations. Moses, make sure you say this to the people before you give them anything. They must know that the Torah is coming to them with this context. The Torah, when it is given, is called the Book of Covenant. In number 7. And Moshe takes the Sefer HaBrit, Vaikach Sefer HaBrit, he takes the Book of the Covenant, Vaikra be'ozne ha'am, and he reads it in the ears of the nation, Vayomeru, and they said, Kol asher diber Adonai, all that God has spoken, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will hear. Okay? So if I realize that God's side of covenant is the written Torah, that frames the written Torah for me. And whatever oral explanations came with it, right? So he's saying, look, for example, you know, you should do Sukkot. as an example. One of the things that's written in the Torah, literally it says, "Basukot tishvu shevat yamim." Sit in the sukkah for 7 days. Very vague. Why? You take for granted that you know what it's talking about. But you're 3,000 years in. Basukot tishvu, what's a sukkah? I mean, what do we consider a sukkah? And when you say sit, does that mean that I'm just supposed to sit there for 7 days? I mean, can I get up? Am I supposed to go inside at all? What does it entail? And 7 days, I mean, is it the daytime? Is it the nighttime? I mean, there's a huge amount of issues that aren't specified. So we have tradition. What the Rambam always calls pishmua, right? What was heard together with the written piece is that God says to Moses, look, well, you see the sukkah thing I'm telling you over here? This is the way it should be. Should be built, you know, it consists of this. Sitting means such and such, and 7 days means this and this, and so on and so forth. So there are some interpretations that we recognize as being given at Sinai by God with the written piece. And so therefore, the written Torah and its interpretations don't change. And there are certain things that we talk about as halakha lemoshe misinai. This is law given to Moses at Sinai. And the interesting thing is, and this is astonishing, but the interesting thing is, there are certain oral laws that nobody argues with. That's the rarest of things, by the way, in Jewish Judaism. Nobody argues with. Nobody says, when it says, "Vilkachtem lachem pri etz hadar," that you should take a citrus fruit on Sukkot, nobody says that that means a tangerine. Nobody argues that it's anything other than the etrog. There's not one opinion in the entirety of Jewish history that claims it should be something other than the etrog. But it's not written in the pasuk. But nobody disagrees with that. Nobody disagrees that, you know, what the lulav is. As an example, right? There are certain things that we just recognize. These are the measures. These are the things that we take. And so this is what's given over. Now, what's the other side of it? If we recognize the written Torah as God's word, and we recognize that his offering of the covenant is essentially the Torah that he gives on Sinai, which is the written pieces and their major definitions, well, where do we come in? Is there anything more than adherence? Yes. There's much more than adherence. We are part of Torah itself. And that's the nature of covenant. That's how it was meant to be. But I'm going to say one thing here, and I'll probably repeat it and sprinkle it throughout. Remember, always, we're not used to thinking this way. Remember, Torah is meant to be lived, adhered to, engaged in the land. So if we're not in the land, there's something severely missing. We're not even in a skeleton structure. We are in a completely misplaced, displaced, thrust out structure. It's a makeshift structure. Let's not forget that. So when we start to talk about why isn't Torah and shouldn't Torah and so on and so forth and so on and so forth, we always forget to take into account, yeah, but we're not home. And we're not in covenant appropriately. There's been a massive breach of covenant throughout. And the very fact that we're not home, logistically, is a serious problem. It stands in the way of major issues. And we all forget that. From the right extreme of orthodoxy to all the way the most liberal left of Judaism, we forget the central place that the land takes in the entirety of the entire thing, of the whole thing. Anybody who believes that they can adhere to their religion in the highest degree outside of the land of Israel is missing this. And anybody who believes that we can run things, you know, outside of the land or live in the land for that matter without having any care about the nature of the covenant itself is missing it. There's something missing. Either that or they're completely disregarding everything that's, you know, that's been written and that has been given over and so on and so forth. And they're creating their own systems. But this is the system that was presented. So, what is our element of it? Our element of it is, okay, thank you very much, God, for giving us the Torah. You've given us principles and some clear definitions of principles. But remember, that the entirety of the written Torah is principle. It's ideas. It's not details. There's not one commandment in the Torah that if I take as it is written, even with some basic definitions, and have any capacity to adhere to in any practical way. You pick it, one of the, any one of them. You want to pick 10 commandments? You call out one of the 10 commandments, anybody. Don't murder. Doesn't say that. No, he was right. See, I want to see. It says don't murder. Lo tirtzach, don't murder. Great. And what do you define as murder? Taking a life? Any life? I mean, what if somebody's coming at me with a knife? What if I'm in America with lunatic guns and all that kind of thing? You know, should I just like watch them coming out? And what do I do? Is that considered murder? And how do I define murder exactly as opposed to don't kill? I mean, what if I'm a soldier in war? All of these questions come up automatically. What else? Anybody else? Honor your parents. That's the best one, right? Whose parents? I mean, are they biological parents? What about adopted parents? Is that included? Do I have to honor them? And what's honor? I mean, who defines what's honor? Is it the parents? Is it me as the child? Is it the Torah? I mean, are there objective honors? There's not one that you can actually live. So it's very important to understand that what was given over on the divine side of covenant were frameworks, principles, ideas. You cannot throw out the fact that I've got to figure out what it means to honor my parents. I can't pretend that the Torah doesn't say to honor my parents. I may be the one, however, that is going to do a great deal of the defining of what's parents and what's honor and in what circumstances, and do I have to pay for it? This is a major question. You tell me to honor my parents. Is it coming out of my bank account or their bank account? That's a major question. And the Talmud says, no, theirs. You don't have to pay for it. If you've got to start drawing money from your bank account to honor your parents, that's a different story. It's not what we're talking about. It shouldn't cost you so much. No, seriously, these are major discussions. And if you've been following my outlines, it'll be more and more so because of the nature of where the Talmud is going lately, but if you've been following my tedious outlines that you better be reading because it takes me a heck of a long time to write those outlines, I'm just telling you, if I find you're not reading them. If you're reading the outlines, you see clearly the questions and discussions that are being raised on very basic law. What you and I will look at and say, oh yeah, okay, I get it. All of a sudden, the questions that are raised, you know, that is a question. I'll give you an example. And you're going to think it's a crazy question. This happened now, this week in the Daf. Witnesses. The Torah says very simply, Al pi shenai medim, o shlosha edim, yakum davar. How do you accept testimony? You need two witnesses, or three, for testimony. In order for testimony to be substantiated. Now, we understand that when we talk about witnesses, a witness, if I have a set of witnesses, three, four, five witnesses, which is the reason why, one of the reasons why it says two or three, because I want to know that even if I have the minimum requirement of two, if I've got more than two, they're all connected. And so I've got a full set of witnesses. And that means that if I've got one witness that isn't a good witness, or that is an invalid witness, it invalidates the entire set. And I do not say that since I've got two good witnesses, I can deal with the minimum. You following? Right. So now, wonderful. So if I've got one witness that invalidates the entire set, one of the things that I know is invalidated, right, is a person that is partial to the case. I can't testify on my own case because I'm partial. Which is the same reason why family can't testify on their case, because you're partial. Well, okay, and what do you mean when you say witness? I mean, are you talking about the person that witnessed the crime? Or are you talking about a person that's come to court to testify? Because if you're saying that it's a person who witnessed the crime, And guess what? You know who witnessed the crime? The criminal and the victim witnessed the crime. And you know what? They're partial. And if you tell me that one witness invalidates the entire group of witnesses, if I've got the criminal and the victim as witnesses, and they're partial, and they're considered one of the witnesses, they invalidate the entire set, you never get off the ground to be able to get a set of witnesses, because there'll always be one of the witnesses. And since they're partial and one of the witnesses, you never get a good set of witnesses. Follow me? This was such a problem that they had to take it to a higher authority. I mean, we're talking to major hachamim over here. And to finally, they go to Rabbi Yochanan, a papa, he goes to Rabbi Yochanan, he says, look, I mean, how do you deal with this? Rabbi Yochanan says, when we say witnesses, we're talking about, not talking about the people who saw the crime, everybody who saw the crime, we're talking about the people, shiyakum yakum davar. It's the people who are going to substantiate the case. Those people are going to go and give testimony to substantiate the case. The people involved in the actual crime are not the ones to substantiate the case. Only witnesses who can substantiate the case are considered witnesses. So that was a little bit of a tour, you know, into the Talmud, right? But I'm saying this as an example. I wasted way too much time with it. But I'm giving this as an example just to bring us into the milieu of what our place in Torah is. That whole discussion, it's a Yisrael side of the covenant discussion. It's not a God discussion. As a matter of fact, and this is going to sound very brazen, but I'm not the first one to say it. Hello, on camera? I'm not the first one to say it. It's going to sound very brazen. God has no business talking about it. He's not allowed to talk about that. He's given his peace. Thank you. You told us. Two or three witnesses. Thank you. You're not allowed to talk anymore. You've given it over. Don't give us stuff with strings attached. Are you giving it to us or you're not? Okay, so if you're giving it to us, then it's now mine. I thank you very much for your gift. I will now decide how we're going to apply this into our human life on this little human planet that you created over here that happens to be revolving around an arbitrary star that we're dealing with. You know how the Chachamim say it? Lo b'shamayim hi. The Torah doesn't exist in heaven. It's left heaven a long time ago. It's now on earth with these human bipeds with meat brains that are now going to be dealing with it. It's a crazy story, which I'm not even going to go into the entire story. Unbelievable story. I mean, I wish I could tell you the story because it's still not amazing. Long story short, a guy wants to manufacture an oven that's not going to become ritually impure. And their ovens were made of earthenware, right? Earthenware was notoriously susceptible to becoming ritually impure. So he wants to try and devise an oven that everybody will agree won't become ritually impure. I mean, look, he's a Jewish businessman. He realizes everybody needs one of those ovens, right? So he makes an oven figuring, like, if I could get all the rabbis to do the kashrus, you know, to give their stamp of approval on it, I'm in the money. How brilliantly, who does he go to first? The most stringent rabbi. Because if I get the most stringent one to say it's okay, everybody else is, you know, it's a piece of cake. So he goes to Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer is a bit Shamaynik, right? He studied in the yeshiva of Shammai. Shammai is notorious for being more stringent than Hillel. Yeah. He goes, look, if I can get Eliezer to say that my oven's going to be good, I'm in. He goes to Eliezer. He says, look, Rabbi, this is my new oven. I'm going to do a, you know, Shark Tank thing. I'm going to show you, like, this whole thing. Well, what do you say? Eliezer says, yeah, it's good. It's good. It's a good oven. Brings it to the other Hachamim, thinking that this is now formality. And the guys who normally are lenient, they look at the oven, they say, no, no. Back to the drawing board. Now, Rabbi Eliezer is in the Bet Midrash, hearing his contemporaries knock his oven. And he decides to go, like, really, really hardcore on everybody. And he gets up and he says, really? Well, if the halakha is like me, the river outside that's running, yeah, it should start flowing backwards. And the river starts flowing backwards. Now, everybody else, now the whole Bet Midrash is going to go, okay, like it's getting really serious right now. You know, so, you know, the Talmidim are getting all really nervous, you know, what's going to happen. Meanwhile, who's there? Rabban Gamliel is there, who's the Nasi, right? He's the chief rabbi, Rabban Gamliel. He's, by the way, you know, related to Rabbi Eliezer. Really, as it happens to be married to his sister. So there's like a whole issue going on over here. Everybody says, Rabban Gamliel gets up and he says, rivers do not determine halakha. We do. So thank you for your magic trick, but we do not accept the oven. And he doesn't take this lying down. He goes through a whole bunch of other magic tricks, right? Whole bunch of magic tricks, right? Major story. But the bottom line of the story is Rabban Gamliel finally gets up and he says, excuse me, lo bashamayim hi. It's not in heaven, and there is no business of heaven piping in on this issue. So the story, later, generations later, this story is given over generations, right? It's a crazy story, yeah? Poor guy, he couldn't do his oven. But in any case, you know, he ends up... And it says that at one point, one of the Hachamim meets up with Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu Navi. He says, I got to ask you. When that whole thing was going on, right, what did God say? And Eliyahu says, he was laughing, saying, Nitzchuni banai. He goes, my children have bested me. They got it, they're right. That's the bottom line, they did it. So some people think that this is a sacrilegious, Pharisee, crazy rabbinic, neurotic lunatic story. But the only reason we would ever see the story that way is if we forget the reality of covenant. If it is genuinely a covenant, their inability to do that would be a sacrilege. The whole point is that we should have a say. And we do have a say. And that's the point of our involvement in Torah law. That is where the oral law really comes alive. The written law is given over by God. The oral law, there are definitions by God, but the essence of oral law, the soul of the oral law, the application and innovation and definition and so on and so forth of mitzvot and how it is that they're applied are in our hands. When is it at its best? When we're in the land and the covenant is intact and we are whole and we're fully plugged in and engaged, which we are not. Which the complaints that we have about Torah, you know, I'll give you an example of a complaint that I hear all the time. Second day of Yom Tov. Right? Yeah. Second day of Yom Tov. Well, first of all, welcome to the outside of Eretz Israel. Everybody wants to live outside of Israel and live like they're living in Israel. There's perks. You don't get that perk when you're living outside of Eretz Israel. That's number one. Number two, even if we wanted to entertain that perk, we have no mechanisms with which to entertain it. Somebody asked me, he goes, like, can't you and the chief rabbi get together and so on? No, we cannot. We know our limits. We're not the Sanhedrin. We are not an official court of Israel that has the jurisdiction to be able to engage on that level of covenant. First of all, we're not home. Second of all, we're not sovereign on that level. And third of all, we're not engaged in even seeing the issues that way. And that's what it takes. So what we end up having in the written law, right, we have the Torah that's given by God. We have the prophets that ultimately, I'm leaving a whole thing out here because it's coming late. And I apologize. But this part of it is the utmost importance. Ideally, what is meant to be is that we are supposed to be able to apply the principles of Torah to our circumstances and to our lives. That's covenant. It's part of the covenant. Take a look. And that's why Wook writes in number 12, he talks about prophet and priest. And how Moshe and Aharon are different. And that what Moshe's job was to be the spokesman for God. So even when Moses speaks, his words become Torah. His prophecy is the written Torah. So the whole book of Deuteronomy is essentially the words of Moses where God says, yeah, we're going to include that. That's written law. And there's a great deal of law in the book of Deuteronomy. Aaron, Aharon's brother, is priest. A priest is for the people. A priest is to be able to help the people into their space of covenant. The job of Aharon was to bring the people into their side of covenant. So he says prophet and priest are different offices. Moses and Aaron are different men. Moses has come out of obscurity at 80 with his mandate from the burning bush. Well, older Aaron is a familiar figure to the tribes. He was with them the whole time. They know who he is. A senior Levite married into the leading family of Judah. as opposed to Moses, who married an Egyptian woman, a Midianite woman. He's obscure. Aaron's not obscure. And so if you take a look at, where am I? Yeah, take a look at number 19. And all you have, by the way, in 17 and 18 is the prototype for what we're going to read about in 19 that's actually in the Bible, right? And what we're reading about is the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is the Supreme Court of Israel. They have the last word on law. So the most difficult issues are brought to them, and their judgment is ultimate law, to the point that we're not even allowed to teach otherwise. We're not allowed to tell people that they're allowed to do otherwise once the law has been established in the Sanhedrin. So it limited argument tremendously because it just defined what the law was going to be. But they were the ones. I mean, obviously, if you're going to want to enact covenant, you're going to engage in the covenant, and there is a book that you're dealing with, you are going to want scholars. You're going to want faithful people. You're going to want people that have dedicated their lives to being able to be aware of its entirety and sensing and knowing the full milieu of its manifestation. Yeah, I mean, you don't want an amateur to come in and mess around in terms of arbitrating covenant. So that's what the Sanhedrin was. Look how Harambam talks about it. Bet din gadol sheberushalayim, the great court in Yerushalayim, hem ikar Torah shebaal peh, they are the main element of the oral Torah. They are the core of the oral Torah. Hem amudei Torah, they are the pillars of teaching in Israel and ruling on law. Umehem, and from them, chok u'mishpat yotzeh lechol Yisrael, law and judgment goes out to the entirety of Israel. So it is a unified nation. It is a central Supreme Court that has jurisdiction and adjudicates for the entire nation in covenant. That's the Torah. That's why he says they are the source of the Torah Shebaal Peh. They themselves are that aspect of the Torah itself. You hear this? Alehim hivtiha Torah. It is upon them that the Torah secured itself. That it is now secured. Shneimar al pi haTorah shor yorucha. You do according to the Torah that they teach you, or that they command to you. Why? Not because they are power mongers. Because they are the ones enacting our side of covenant. You need somebody who's going to be proficient, professional, faithful, scholarly, and so on and so forth, to engage in the best levels of enacting covenant. That's the way it works. Zomis vatasev, b'chol ha'amim b'Moshe Rabbeinu, anybody who has any faithfulness in Moshe Rabbeinu, u'b Torato, and in his Torah, which is what? It's the entirety, of course, but essentially it's the written Torah and its definitions that are given by God. Through Moshe, hayav lismoch ma'aseh hadat. They must lean the active elements of the law. How do I enact the principles that are given by God? You lean the active elements of the law on them. Lishayin alehem. You do it on them. They're the ones that take our role in the covenant. And they define it. And it is to the degree that if in a later generation, a later Supreme Court sees that the definitions of a previous Supreme Court are no longer applicable, or they recognize it to be different, understand it differently than the previous Supreme Court did, they can change it. That's law. Today, it's a complete mess. It's a complete mess on every level. And that is why we pray three times a day to bring back the Supreme Court. In our Amidah, Hashiva Shofetenu Kevarishona, return our judges as they once were, V'yoatzenu Kevatechilan, our advisors as they were in the beginning, Haser Mimenu, and we say the next words are, take away from us Yagon V'anaha, agony and crying, despair. Agony and despair, yes, agony and despair. That's what we all experience. We just don't admit that we experience it. And we believe that we can solve it simply by adjusting a few things. But the core of the problem is covenant. That's the issue. And so therefore, once God gives the Torah, He has said all that He's going to say. We don't accept His words anymore after that. In terms of what? In terms of defining law. He can tell us, listen, you're going off a little, which is what the entirety of the prophets is, isn't it? It was a whole, every haftarah, I mean, if you read, I read, wrote on the haftarah last year, it's basically all about relationship. The whole thing is about, look, I don't like how you're relating to me. I don't like how you're keeping the covenant. I don't like how you're keeping the covenant. I don't like how you're keeping, I mean, like every week, it's another way of basically saying, listen, your relationship tactics are a disaster. You guys just really don't know how to have relationships. Or it's, I love you so much, and I'm going to bring you back, and so on and so forth, which is basically Isaiah. Nobody other than Isaiah really does any of that. But that's what it is. The whole of Nevi'im is that, but it's certainly not law. Which is why, if you see, in number 15, Maimonides writes, in his introduction to the Mishnah, he says, you should know, Dasha Nivua lo toril biyunu pirushei Torah. Prophecy will not help us at all in terms of defining and explaining the laws of the Torah. Ela mashiaseh Yeshua Pinhas binyanei ha'ayun ve'adin hu mashiaseh rivin Avraham Asher. From the death of Moses, our involvement in the Torah was definitions, derivations, readings, not prophecies in terms of you will now do this. Moses said, hold on, let me ask God. Joshua couldn't say, hold on, let me ask God. He had to say, hold on, let me look at the book. And let's figure out what the book says. And that's how it's always been throughout. And that's why covenant, back to covenant, was reestablished when Joshua brings the people into the land. For 40 years in the desert, there wasn't milah, there was no brit done. Everybody comes back into the land, and it's renewed. That's number 14. God says, you better get some knives out. It's time to reenact the covenant. Get the blades. Shuv molet ben Israel shenit, circumcise Israel a second time. Meaning, not a second time for the people. It means a second round, right? In other words, the kids. The kids that were born in the Midbar. So what does that mean for us? I want to end with this. First of all, it means that the entirety of mitzvot, the whole of Torah, everything about Jewish life is a question of our relationship with God and our adherence to covenant. It's the only question. So whether we recognize mitzvot as applicable today or not applicable today, moral or not moral, so on and so forth, those are secondary questions. They're, in a sense, faint echoes of the real question. They're ancillary issues. The main issue is, what does the covenant mean to me? Do I recognize myself as a member of the covenant of Abraham? And do I see that Torah has been for my people and will be for my people the source of that covenant? And therefore, what do the elements that are written within it mean to me? At the end of the day, if we take that to its furthest conclusion, a mitzvah is an act of love. Because the nature of our covenant is not just to be able to build buildings and get into deals. The nature of our covenant is relationship. You shall be for me a people, and I will be for you a God. You shall be a treasured nation, and I will cherish you. I brought you out on the wings of eagles. That's the preamble. That's the whole of the everything that we have. And to understand Torah in any other context is to see it outside of its rightful context. And you've heard me speak about context. It defines everything within. The context defines the details. If I remove a detail from the context, the detail no longer retains its value. It takes on the value of whatever context within which it's embedded. And so if I look at a mitzvah outside of that context, it's not the same mitzvah. Simple as that. That's not a religious statement. That's just a real logical statement. So I can have a mitzvah, adhere to a mitzvah. The mitzvah can look, smell, feel like the mitzvah. But if I am adhering to that mitzvah in some foreign context, I don't recognize that it is an element of covenant between me and God, and that essentially it's an act of love, It's not the same mitzvah. That is the basis for all of it. The covenant itself was only established on the fact that we should have involvement and engagement in the Torah. Take a look. I'll tell you where to look in a second. Number 16. Amar Rabbi Yohanan. Rabbi Yohanan said, Lo karat HaKadosh Baruch Hu Brit im Yisrael. God only established covenant with Israel Bishvil Devarim Shebaal Peh, for the oral element of it. Otherwise, it's just God telling us what to do. The whole aspect of us being involved, that's what the covenant was based on. The oral aspects. Shenemar Al Pi HaDvarim HaEle Karati Otcha. Based on the Peh, on the mouth of these things, the verbal aspects of these things, I established my covenant with you, Israel. The parts that you're supposed to be able to engage in, you're supposed to dialogue in, you're supposed to talk about and discover and apply. That is what Torah is. And when we forget that, we forget, really, the entire context of Torah. And it becomes something else. And just because somebody might be doing a mitzvah and it looks like a mitzvah and it's following the rules of a mitzvah, but the context within which that mitzvah is happening is some foreign context, it's not the same mitzvah. And therefore what Aharon did was not just bring people into synagogue. It's important to understand this. And I really want you to focus here for me, okay? I want you to focus on my last lines. Aharon bringing people in. What Hillel says, right? Hillel says, be of the students of Aharon. Ohev shalom, love peace. Rodev shalom, run after peace. Ohev et abriyot, love all creatures, the creations. Umkarvan la Torah, and bring them close to Torah. What does that mean, bring them close to Torah? It doesn't just mean get them to synagogue and give them a mitzvah to do. That's not enough. It means show them their place in covenant. Let them know that they are part of the covenant. Embrace the people. Allow them to recognize that this is about love and partnership. That this is covenant. And therefore, that's what Aharon did. He brought people. Moses spoke and gave out God's side, and Aharon said, and come, let me show you your place within this. And if I cannot find my place within it, then there's something missing. Because you can give me a lulav on the street, and I can say the bracha and do it, and that's wonderful. If I have a sense that I'm part of the Jewish enterprise, okay, that could be enough. But if it's done with love, and I have a sense that I'm part of something great, and that this lulav, because of it, the palm branch suddenly takes on tremendous meat. Wonderful. But it doesn't stand on its own. And my last point is this. It is for this reason that it is absolutely abhorrent for anyone who claims to be a scholar, teacher, leader within the milieu of covenant to speak in any disparaging way of the people of the covenant. Because it causes the members of the covenant to feel alienated from the covenant. And there is nothing worse that someone could do. And with that, I will end, not with my words saying it, with the Rambam. The Rambam says in his Igeret HaShmad, he writes a letter to people in... Where is it? Yemen. That's Igeret Teman, but there's another Igeret Teshmad where there was like these horrible, horrible persecutions going on. And the rabbis of the place, there was a rabbi of the place that was saying that the people are going to hell if they do anything, you know, against Torah and mitzvot and so on and so forth, saying very bad things about the people. So the Rambam is writing to console these people and give them guidance. And he says, I want to tell you something. Three of the greatest leaders of Israel slipped in their noble work and faithful jobs and said disparaging things about the people of Israel and God didn't let it slide. They were called on it. Who? Moshe, Eliyahu HaNavi, and Isaiah the prophet. It's pretty big. I mean, you don't get bigger than Moshe, Eliyahu, and Isaiah the prophet. They're about as big as you get. I mean, who had more than that? Look at what he says. Im ken na'anshu gedolei ador va'amodei olam. If we realize that the great ones of the generation, Moses, Elijah, Isaiah, they were punished. They were the great ones of the world. They were the highest leaders that we had. If they were punished because they said something not nice about the Jewish people, I mean, look, they had it rough. The people weren't exactly the easiest in the world to deal with, you know. They did their best. Or they said, ugh, you know, whatever it was that they said about the people. Wasn't allowed to slide. They were called on it by God. If that's what happened to the pillars of the world, Moshe, Eliyahu, and Isaiah, and the Malachim for that matter, the Malachim, when they say anything about Israel, God never tolerates it. The angels, when this happened, when they tried to speak about the congregation of Israel, me'at devarim, what did they say? Few things. They didn't go on diatribes. Few insulting things. Kol sheken, how much more so? Kal mikalei olam, the people of the lighter people in the world, who are not Moses and Elijah and so on and so forth, Yatir Lishono will allow his tongue to speak al kehilot Israel, on the congregations of Israel that include Hachamim, Talmidim, their students, Kohanim, Leviim, and he calls them what? Poshim, they're rebellious, Rishaim, they're wicked evildoers, Goyim, they're not even Jewish, Psuler Edut, they can't testify, they're not even fit to testify, Kofrim Barshem, they don't believe in God, they don't follow the Torah. V'ichtov ha'davar hazeh, God forbid they should say it, but write it. Ma yeh onsho, I can't imagine what his punishment would be, says Maimonides. If this would happen to Moses, I shudder to think what the punishment of someone would be. And the point, the reason I end with this is because it's dangerous. And it's not acceptable. Because the whole of our lives with God is covenant. And the entirety of Torah is covenant. And it is our inheritance. It belongs to us. Which is why I'm calling this Morasha, which simply means inheritance. And every member of Israel has a right to it. Everyone. And for us to do anything that would repel anyone, make anyone feel that they're not welcome in it, that it's not theirs, that it doesn't belong to them, that they have no business, and so on and so forth, it's the wrong direction. And so that is how severe Harambam sets it. And that's why Aharon was the, so to speak, wingman of Moshe. And where Moshe was giving out the law, the principles, the ideas from God, and Aharon was bringing people in to show them their place in covenant. And that's the template that we should have today. Okay, so that is our presentation for the first Morasha. Next month, we will be looking at the opening paragraphs of Rambam's Mishneh Torah, in which he speaks about God and who is God. And so we're going to look at that, please God, next time. Are there any questions? Yes.
I would like some clarification on the teachings and philosophy of Nachmanides and the Rambam.
I can't do that now, because that's a whole other subject. Right. But they lived, they overlap, they were similar time, but different approaches. Yes?
There's one thing that I'm struggling with slightly, which is the, where the Torah Shabbat Al-Peh comes together with the Lava Shamayim, because the tradition is that it's not all interpreted. Some of it is exactly what was said to Moshe.
Correct.
Passed down. And at some stage, it becomes more derivative.
Yes.
And
no, well, okay. Yeah.
And there was something when you presented it there, it was a bit of a blurring.
Okay, so let me clarify that. The question is, how do we see with regards to the oral Torah, where we go from some things, like I said, were explained by God to Moses orally, and other things ended up being derived by the people. It's not some stage. Right? It's not at some stage, unless we look at the death of Moshe as being the beginnings of that stage. There were elements that were simply not explained. And whatever wasn't explained is left up to the people to do. And that's really the way the Rambam puts it in the Hakdamah. He says, Mashalodni Peresh, right? Whatever wasn't explained, it's open game. Right? And so that's essentially what we deal with. Anything that has to be applied and understood and practiced in terms of our lives that we don't have clarity on, that's the way it was done. I haven't spoken about what we do today, but that's for another time. I'm going to get to it later. But yeah, okay? Yes?
Sorry, I asked you the other day in chapter 11.
Yeah.
He mentions a rabbi that kept shouting, "What is Rashi's question?"
Right.
So what is Rashi's question?
What he means, what was Rashi's question when Herman Wook writes that? He's not talking about a specific question. That's always how we study Rashi. Because we are always looking to see. Remember, Rashi did not have Rashi. You know, as a commentator of the Torah, Rashi didn't have Rashi. So what Rashi's looking at is the text. And Rashi is looking at the text, and he's got questions. And so he imagines if he's got the questions, guess who else has the questions? You and me. And so he writes the answer to the questions. But when we read the answer, it's like Jeopardy. What's the question? Right? So we look at Rashi, we see that he puts out an answer, but we want to know, well, what question did he think we were supposed to be thinking about? And that's always how we study Rashi. Mahu kshal Rashi, right? What's his issue? Right? Why? What's bothering Rashi? Right? Why did he bother taking his quill out and dipping it into the ink and putting out those words that he put out? That's the issue. One more, yes, sir. Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned that the mitzvah is the meeting of the framework principles with the details and the context, but if it's in the wrong context, then you're not doing the mitzvah properly. On the other hand, you said that the Sanhedrin set things.
The question being, they asked me to repeat the question. The question being, if I'm saying that the context, if mitzvot are performed in a foreign context, and that once the Sanhedrin has established something, unless we have another Sanhedrin, they can't change it, which I didn't say, although you're bringing your own knowledge to the thing. I didn't mention that tonight. But it's true. Yeah. So once the Sanhedrin establishes something, you need a Sanhedrin to be able to negotiate it or adjust it. And if we don't have a Sanhedrin to adjust it, then being 1,000 years ago, or even 2,000 years ago, surely we must be doing mitzvot in the wrong context. But no. Because remember, when we talk about context, we're not talking about contemporary situations. We're talking about the context in which it was presented. And the context is always covenant. That doesn't change. So it may be that the covenant is quite musty, and the practice of it is out of date, but that's just as much our fault. I mean, we're the ones that have the relationship problems. And so if that's the case, right, you know, things are going to break down. Welcome to Galut. It's what it feels like to be in a completely devastated system of full, robust, intimate, engaged relationship. And that's precisely how it's supposed to feel. Precisely how it's supposed to feel. I'm going to take some questions from online. Can you repeat the questions? I did. Thank you very much. How do we know which details were explained by God to Moshe and which were derived later? We don't have a list, you know, that goes through what it is that God specifically said and what he didn't say. And as a matter of fact, as time goes on, there are discussions in the Talmud as to what it was that he said and what he didn't say. So there are certain things that we have quite clear as to what it was that Moshe gave over to Moshe. We call them either Halakha al-Moshe Misinai, or we say Mepi Hashem Alamdu. We learned this from, you know, the voice, you know, that was spoken to Moshe, and so on and so forth. But as a result of 2,000 years of Galut, it's extremely difficult to be able to differentiate and discern. But there are systems in which we look at it, and there are basic principles that we use in order to be able to recognize them. So those are established. Okay, I'm going to say Kaddish, and then I'd like to stay here to pray Arbit, if that's okay with you, although I will need the women and men to separate in order for us to be able to pray Arbit, frankly. רבי חנניה בן עקשיא אומר, רצה הקדוש ברוך הוא לזכות ישראל, לפי כך הרבה להם תורה ונצוות שנאמר, אדוני חפץ למען צדקו, יגדיל תורה וידיר, יתגדל ויתקדש שם הרבה. ועלמא דיברה כרותיה וימליך מלכותיה ויצמח וקנה וקרב משיחיה.